Comic book, does whatever a book does. Read by us while drinking, incoherent rambling. Look out, this is our podcast.
Welcome to the SJW Comic Book Club, a weekly book club style podcast where three friends discuss a story arc or event in comics. Like most successful book clubs, we have three key elements: books, friends, and booze. I'm host number one, Monte.
I'm host number two, Veronica.
And I'm host number three, Melissa.
The three of us have been friends for years, ever since middle school, and we've always been really into books, movies, and other types of media. We've also always talked to each other quite a bit about what we're watching or reading, because the best part about consuming media is talking about it with your friends. So that's what we do with this podcast. We take a story arc in comics, and we discuss it from a literary and progressive point of view. And this week, in addition to the three of us, we have a special guest, Michael from Superhero Politics.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me. My name is Michael Holmes, and I host Superhero Politics. When people ask what Superhero Politics is, it's just kind of two things that I love. I've been around politics since I was about 15, so roughly, 30 plus years now, and love comic books ever since. And the one thing that got me into politics was noticing some of the themes in comic books. When we talk about discrimination, we talk about communities that are oppressed, we talked about, abuse of power, all these things parallel with politics and awesome story arcs from comic books. And if you've, seen our politics lately, it's kind of comical. So, I talk about the comical nature of politics and the political nature of comics. So that's how Superhero Politics was born. And it's been great. Thank you guys for having me.
Yes, you're very welcome.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. And before we start with today's episode, just to have a brief check-in, what are you guys reading or watching this week that's making you feel all warm and fuzzy inside?
I can go first. So I don't know that it's necessarily warm and fuzzy, but at about 2 o'clock last night, I finished reading The Duke and I by Julia Quinn, which is the book that Bridgerton is based on. It was pretty good, but it's really just like your typical bodice ripper type romance. Pretty funny in some places. I think Meg Cabot does it a little better, the same stuff, but maybe give it a read if you liked Bridgerton, which I have not watched, but I was intrigued by its existence. So I thought I'd read the book. I got it from the library. It took me like 2 months after having placed it on hold to get it because so many people wanted to read it.
Yes. That's nice. It's always good when a popular TV show or something encourages people to read the original work.
Yes. I will specify that it's not POC diverse like the TV show is. It's just everyone is white, but
Well, what are you going to do?
I didn't know if everybody knew that.
The guy who plays Simon isn't going to be in season two because he was never going to be in season two, but right. They've officially announced it and now everyone's upset.
It's so pretty sad. Devastating, I gotta say.
It was trending on Twitter, like literally trending on Twitter. Like all of a sudden, all this massive buzz from the first season is going to die.
Yeah.
So sad.
I mean, like, good for
him.
What was his name?
Reggie. I think it's pronounced Reggie Jean Page. Jean Page, I don't know.
Jean Page.
I think it's Jean, it's just one N and no E.
Great for Reggie Jean Page. His career is just going places. He's got all kinds of things. He's going to be in a D&D movie, by the way.
Oh, he's going to be in a D&D movie.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Watch that when that comes out.
Very good, very good. How about you, Melissa?
Last night I watched the movie Terminal, about the guy who gets stuck in an airport, and it wasn't as good as I remembered it being. And I also thought that Tony Shalhoub was the main character. It turns out it's Tom Hanks cosplaying as Tony Shalhoub, and that's right? Why I forgot who was in that movie.
But I've never heard a more true statement.
Yeah, I was like, Tony Shalhoub is definitely in this movie. No.
I've never heard anyone disappointed that they got Tom Hanks over Tony Shalhoub. Like, you're the first person ever to say, oh my God, I thought this was Tony Shalhoub. And it was just Tom Hanks.
Like, it was just Tom Hanks, you guys.
It was just Tom Hanks.
What a letdown.
can I say? I love me some Shalhoub.
I don't know why that was so funny.
It is pretty great. What about you, Michael?
I have just been consuming all of the superhero content on TV. Like the Lois, Superman and Lois, you know, Falcon and Winter Soldier, all those things. I broke down and sequestered 4 hours to watch the Snyder Cut of Justice League. So that's really what I've been into lately. And then it's just so much content out there. And then, you know, Invincible is now on Amazon. It's just so much content. Like, I never imagined when I was a kid growing up that we would be inundated with so much superhero content. Like, it's just voluminous. So I love it.
Yes. How did you like the Snyder Cut?
If I ever see Joss Whedon on the street, he's going to catch these hands. Like, he's going to catch these hands. Like, he's got to see me. Like, he literally made us die for 3+ years thinking that this was it. And, like, this is a whole nother movie. It's a whole nother movie. And it's a whole nother, just a image of what it should have been. I mean, yeah, there could have been some things that were edited out and it could have been condensed a little bit, but compared to what
I think there was quite a bit.
Yeah, but compared to what Whedon put out, it was night and day. So, you know, like I said, Joss Whedon, if you ever see me, it's not going to be a pleasant encounter.
I think there's a lot of people who might say that. Have you seen the new trailer for the new Suicide Squad?
I have.
Lots of rumble of that. So, I saw Gail Simone's like Twitter second by second of the trailer, and she seemed to be really excited about it.
Well, it's trying to reclaim what the original should have been from the R-rated standpoint. I mean, Suicide Squad is so gritty and so dark. Task Force X, and it just got caught up in the churn of trying to compete with the lightheartedness of Marvel. And Suicide Squad is never meant to be that. So hopefully it seems to get back to where the original intent of that particular leg of the franchise is supposed to be. So hopefully they do well, but, you know, I'm not optimistic all the time for DC.
Fair.
Yes. I will never, ever, ever be excited for any superhero movie ever again without reservations.
Right. Yes. You got to go in with tempered the understanding expectations.
That I probably will be disappointed.
Yeah.
It's better to go into it like that.
Yes.
Than to have high expectations and be disappointed versus like medium to low expectations and then it can only go up.
Right. Unless it's or just absolute stay right there. Trash. Unless it actively hurts you, you can't be disappointed if you have low expectations.
Like Endgame hurt me.
Right. Or like Cyberpunk gives people seizures without having had a seizure warning before it.
Mm.
Actively injuring.
Hey, that's not as bad as Sia's movie about autism where they have a sequence of like strobe lights, which a lot of autistic people can't.
Right.
Are like epileptic and they can't watch that kind of stuff. So she literally made a movie that the people she's trying to make the movie for can't even watch it.
Sabotaged it for them.
So
that's
that was not the only complaint about that movie. There's a lot of complaints about that movie.
Yes. How about you, Monte?
So in preparation of Godzilla versus Kong, the blockbuster that came out a few days ago. That is probably going to change my life. We'll see if it's for the better or the worse. I'm going to watch it after we're done here.
Just talked about how you should have low expectations.
That's not a superhero movie, so.
Okay.
I thought we played that.
Excuse you?
It's a monster disaster movie. It's
yeah,
totally
that's
different.
A monster movie, and I also know exactly what I'm going to be getting, and that's what I want. You know, I'm not invested in Godzilla as a character or King Kong as a character, and I don't have to be. I just want to see them fight, and I'm very excited to see it. But I've been watching all the Godzilla and King Kong movies, like the recent modern remakes of them. I don't remember when the first one came out, but yeah. Aaron Taylor Johnson is in one of them. He's the love of my life that I've never met, but one day I will, and it'll be a beautiful day.
For the whole world?
Yeah, for the whole world and for me. Nice, so that's nice. What I've been watching, and it's been pretty cool.
Beautiful.
And nobody can tell me that the Godzilla movies aren't great. They're great movies, and if you have any opinions other than that, you can shut the hell up. <I don't care>. Tell your mother.
I mean, I really can't argue, because if that's your stance, what can anyone say?
Exactly.
There's no big theological, artistic argument about why Godzilla is or is not the pinnacle of human advancement.
Yeah, it's just like a law. You can't argue with gravity, and Godzilla is one of the best movies ever. How about that?
How do you feel about the movie Rampage with Dwayne The Rock Johnson in it?
Also a great movie. Dwayne The Rock Johnson is in it. It's got a giant gorilla, a giant wolf. Was there a giant crocodile in that movie?
Yeah.
There was. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was the trifecta.
And the wolf actually flew.
Ooh.
It did. It was wolf a flying flew. Squirrel wolf.
It was a flying squirrel wolf. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I've seen that movie. That movie is top notch.
Fire.
Yeah. That's the genre that I love. Giant animals that tear up things or eat people. That's giant, like, the kind of movies that I enjoy. Yeah.
So did you like the Pacific Rim movies? Did you like those?
I love the first one. The first one is amazing. The second one, it wasn't, they lost touch. It's like they didn't understand what was good about the first one. What was good about Pacific Rim wasn't Charlie Hunnam and what's her name? They did a great job, but like the focus of the movie should always be on the giant monsters. Like it always needs to be on the kaiju. They're the important thing. It's what people want to see. And in the second one, they tried to make it something that it wasn't. It's just, it's not going to have emotional weight. Like, I don't care about anything that's happening with the humans in these movies. I don't understand why you want to. Why do you want me to care? Why?
The only woman in the first 10 credits on Pacific Rim is Rinko Kikuchi.
Yes, that's her name, Rinko Kikuchi. I didn't want to say her, the name of her character, because it annoys me when people do that. People do that a lot with actors and actresses of color, where they forget their actual names and just call them the character names, and that annoys me. So
we just call me out from earlier when I couldn't remember Simon's name.
Yeah, Melissa.
Melissa, okay. The source of the problem.
Yeah, I'm glad you caught that shade. I'm just kidding. I completely forgot that happened, and now I would like to take back what I said.
I mean, I looked up his name.
Yeah, you did. You looked it up. You didn't remember, but you looked it up. So
yeah,
there you go. But yeah, I love the first Pacific Rim movie. The second one was okay, but it could have been better if there was less humans and more monsters.
Fair.
And that's the case with any movie.
With all movies in all genres.
Yeah. Crazy Stupid Love. Where's the giant gorilla? I don't understand what's going on here.
Happiest Season movie that came out. where's the giant monster?
I was told there was a crocodile. I don't understand. So for each season, Veronica and I pick a theme. This season, my theme was LGBT superhero couples.
And my theme this season was green. And for my ultimate episode in season 6 of the green theme, we have the ultimate green character, the Incredible Hulk. So the comic we read is Incredible Hulk Volume 2, number 24 through 25, only 2 issues. It was written in 2001, written by Paul Jenkins, art by John Romita Jr., ink by Dick Giordano and Tom Palmer, colors by Arcia Rosagar and Avalon Studios, and letters by John Workman, and edited by Tom Brevoort and Mark Sumerak. So, in case you don't know who the Hulk is the alter ego of theoretical physicist Dr. Bruce Banner. While developing the first gamma bomb, he was bombarded with a massive dose of gamma radiation and mutated into the Hulk, a being of mindless rage. He lived on the run until finding a temporary home with the Avengers, and, you know, at various points he has moved on and done other things. So, background for this particular story, Bruce Banner fell in love with Betty Ross before he mutated into the Hulk while he was developing the Gamma Bomb for the U.S. Defense Department. Betty Ross was the daughter of the general in command of his base that he was working at. However, they would not marry for many years after an incident in which Hulk and Banner were separated, like, physically and, you know, psyche-wise, by comic book science, our favorite thing. However, at some point, Banner's body could not endure the separation, and Vision actually had to put them back together. But in that time while they were separated, Banner and Betty were able to get married. So later, Betty was in danger of dying from proximity exposure to Bruce Banner's gamma radiation. He attempted to cure her through a blood transfusion, which is actually how She-Hulk, a character we've met before, was created as well. But the Abomination, his arch nemesis, secretly switched the blood transfusion with the Abomination's blood, and Betty died. So the Abomination is Emil Blonsky, a Croatian spy who was exposed to gamma radiation as well while trying to sabotage the base where Banner was developing the gamma bomb. The Abomination is always mutated. He has twice the baseline strength of the Hulk. Sometimes the Hulk, you know, further mutates. I'm not sure about the science of it, but the baseline Abomination is twice as strong. But he retains his intelligence while being mutated. He sees Banner as better off than him, but also as a monster, and is devoted to bringing him down. So in this story, both Bruce Banner and Emil Blonsky, the Abomination, think back on their lives and what they have lost. Banner's father-in-law, General Ross, comes to visit him, insisting that the Abomination needs to pay for what he did to Betty. Banner is resistant at first, having previously somewhat chosen to forgive him, but after being pushed, he transforms into the Savage Hulk and goes to exact his revenge. So, in accordance with that synopsis and theme, Melissa, what drink have you prepared for just me this week?
The theme drink for this week was supposed to be a lazy apple teeny, which is basically, if you don't have a drink shaker or anything, you just pour an amount of vodka and an amount of apple pucker into a glass and you call it a day. But I'm feeling under the weather. Monte's feeling under the weather. So Veronica's the only one who I was able to give this drink to. And Michael has got his own fancy drink, which he can tell us about.
I don't know about fancy, but it's, you know, I'm not much of an alcohol drinker. So I decided opt for a lighter fare today. I have what is affectionately known as the Doc Samson. Like, it is sparkling water with some lime kombucha with some kiwi and lime slices in it. And so it's a little lighter, a little more, you know, gut friendly, I should say, but tasty nonetheless. So, you know, in essence of, in kind of spirit of this episode, not having as much power as, say, the lazy apple teeny, I went with the Doc Samson.
Nice.
Yep. But they're both green themed, so that's what's important, actually.
The most important part. Okay, so having read this very short reading assignment, but quite wordy and quite full of meaning, what is you guys' general impression of this short arc?
Well, I'll go first.
Okay.
It's pain, man. Like, there is just pain. All throughout this, everybody is hurting. There's not a single character, main character in these two issues that's not in pain. I mean, everybody from Thunderbolt Ross to Blonsky to Bruce to even to some extent, you know, his additional alters with, with pain. Like, you know, you think back and earlier you said that Bruce came to grips with it. And I was thinking, wow, that was really Professor Hulk that made peace with Abomination on this. And so it's even pain. It's just people are so hurting because of just the interaction that they've had around this incident and how their lives have intersected and some of the things that they've been forced to do to feel some relief from that. So it's really just very compact, but so much pain in these two issues.
For sure.
I thought the story was pretty well paced for only being two issues. Mm-hmm. I mean, quite a lot happens, but it starts off pretty solid and is just kind of maintains that storytelling throughout the two issues.
Yeah, I agree that it was a really well-paced story. And also, I really appreciated the theme of, like, not moving on from things that have happened in the past. Like, all three characters, and I would include old Thaddeus in this as well, Thaddeus Ross, like, they have, at a certain point in the story, each one of them comes to a sort of crossroads where they can either move on from what's happened, whether it be for Bruce and Thaddeus, the death of Betty, or for Emil, I guess just his transformation into the Abomination. Like, he's weirdly holding on to his relationship with his ex-wife, whose name I can't remember.
Nadia, I believe.
Yeah, Nadia. But then also, like, wanting to move on from it, so he'll call her and then not say anything, like, to the point where she thinks he's a stalker. But each of them comes to a point in the story where they can choose whether they're going to move on from the stuff in their past or if they're going to, like, basically just drown in it. And I think that it's interesting that all of them, including the hero, choose to not move on. Which is kind of depressing and kind of pessimistic, I guess, but it's also, I think, pretty realistic because it's very difficult to move on from trauma or from hurt or pain, like Michael said. So I really appreciated that theme and the way that it was used and the way that it was illustrated in these three characters that seem to be very different, but they all make the same choice, which I always think is interesting, whether it's a good choice or a bad choice.
Well, we should have seen this coming, though, because when Emil is teaching his writing class at the library, which I loved that he just was doing that, he said the happy endings are for lazy writers. So we should have known from that point on that nothing good was going to happen.
Yes.
Paul Jenkins told us. He
there will not
us.
Be a happy ending.
Yeah.
Foreshadowing.
Yes. Yeah, my general impression, I was really happy to find this story when I was looking for a Hulk story to read, because a lot of them are very long.
A little bit.
Yeah, I feel like we don't know a lot about the Hulk apart from, like, his existence as a character. Like, Monte and Michael, if any time in this episode I'm like, what is the Hulk's deal? And you know, please feel free to tell me, because I don't know much about his story. I think when I introduced this story to Melissa, she was like, who, Betty Ross? Who is this person who's in love with the Hulk? Like, his backstory and, you know, relationships aren't super well known if you don't read Hulk comics, because he ends up being just a big smashy monster in, like, Avengers movies and stuff. So I was really pleased to find this sort of more contemplative arc, but it still had, you know, Hulk smashing in it. So it really felt like, and maybe I'm off base, it really felt like a good intro point to the character that included the spectrum of aspects of what a Hulk story could be.
I think so, yeah. I
think that's a really good point, because you get introduced to the kind of the totality of the Hulk. I mean, because you see this big smashy monster, and I love the word smashy. you see this big smashy monster, but you look inside that there's so much depth and there's so many different facets of that in terms of how many different personalities exist within this one psyche? Like, how many different layers of rage and anger and disappointment? All these emotions have manifested themselves as individual people or beings that will emerge at a given point in time. Really based around this one fragile but very, you know, brilliant person. But you see that kind of played out in this issue, because you get introduced to Grey Hulk, you get introduced to Professor Hulk, you get introduced to Savage Hulk, all these different alternative personalities of the single character. So if you're coming into Hulk for the first time and you want to truly understand, you know, I guess the psyche of the Hulk, this would be a pretty good episode to get into that, because it gives you the backstory of Betty, and it gives you the backstory of General Ross, and it gives you the backstory of, you know, his nemesis, the Abomination. It gives you all that, and then it gets to let you see even deeper into what the character, you know, will be sometimes that you, when you read it.
Yeah, I gave the backstory of those characters as much as I could concisely in the synopsis, but if you're just jumping in and reading it, they really give you pretty much all that you need. I think they could have done a little bit more background, like scene setting about the concept of what Professor Hulk is and stuff, but I think you can get it from context clues. So, Michael, what you were saying in your general impressions about like everyone being in pain in these comics and all the characters, I hadn't really thought of it from that point of view, but it kind of reminded me of the X-Men. I don't know if I ever said this in the podcast, but talking to Monte about the way that Cyclops and Wolverine act after the death of Jean Grey, especially in, which one was it, Monte, with Hope?
Oh, Avengers versus X-Men.
Avengers versus X-Men, yeah. Where I really thought that a lot of the way that both of those characters act was, and a lot of other characters as well, like spawns off from the point where Jean Grey died. A lot of subsequent events and the emotions that a lot of people have circle around the death of one character. And I thought that was interesting that you said Betty Ross's death, or for Emil, losing his life by being irradiated, which is also a big event, is really what everyone's like circling around there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's there's always a unifying, or like a, what I like to call a bridge character between, you know, an antagonist and the protagonist. Like, and Betty is that between, you know, Thunderbolt Ross and Bruce Banner. Like, she's that thing that bridges them together. You know, I have two daughters. So, you know, I could be very Thunderboltish about boys who come into my daughter's life. So, and none of them are, you know, rage monsters that I know of. But, you know, you look at that character and you look at how they're linked together. But then you also look at the other love of Thunderbolt's life, and that's the military. And, you know, what he sees as this incredible weapon that Bruce Banner can be, and how he's even able to use, you know, his daughter, which he loves dearly, to try to accomplish one end, or, you know, to this other end. And so, you know, he's hurting, yes, that his daughter is gone, but he's not going to let that tragedy go to waste and lose out on the other thing that he dearly loves. So he'll use the death of his daughter to try to control the Hulk. So it's, you know, he's a very kind of, just kind of a, you know, has multiple dichotomies in this this character, but everybody's in pain because of this one character. She bridges these two guys together, and then ultimately the accident, which changed Blonsky, causes him to lose the love of his life. So it's all love and loss. It's kind of, you know, the center of this pain here. So very similar to what you're saying about Jean Grey. It's love and loss. You know, it's, they go hand in hand.
I was just thinking that the ending to this, where after the big smashy fight scene, where the Hulk smashes the Abomination, and instead of just taking him to whatever supervillain jail, they set him up to be tortured for the rest of his life,
forever,
essentially, by you know, making him watch over and over again a conversation he had with his, well, now wife. I don't remember if they were dating at the time or married.
Right.
But in one of the last times he ever saw her, she says, "I'll always love you no matter what." And they just torture him with it. And I was like,
this is pretty torturing. Well.
Not maybe an ending you might expect from someone who's supposed to be the hero and being self-sacrificing and being better and taking the high road.
Right. And I don't know what happens after these issues, but after that, Bruce Banner is walking away in his like lab coat from being in this facility where the Abomination is being held, and he is transforming into the Hulk as he walks away. So I don't know what happens next, but I wonder if like that's some sign of his attitude going forward, like he's embracing the Hulk or embracing cynicism and violence or something. Like, not sure. It seemed like a very, yeah, not necessarily like a bad ending, but not the ending that you would expect from a hero.
Yeah, it was very subversive.
Mm-hmm.
And not too optimistic, not too hopeful.
Not necessarily sad, but maybe just cynical or...
Yeah. I thought it was a bit sad because, like, seeing people wallow in grief, well, I don't think wallow necessarily, because he is, like, Bruce Banner, is, I believe it implied that this is the first time that he's actually, like, dealt with it.
Right.
And then, in addition to that, he saw, like, Betty's body kind of frozen and in stasis by her psychotic father. So, which is just so creepy. Like, I'm not sure where that thought enters someone's head to do that. Like, at what point do you have a certain path that you take for grief? You know, you go A to B, B to C, C to D, and Thaddeus just, he just got off track somewhere, and I'd like to know where. When did it happen?
It reminds me exactly of Mr. Freeze from DC Bat. Like, he's keeping his wife in stasis, and there's, like, this veneer of, like, someday I'll be able to cure the illness she has, and she'll be able to live from that point on. And, Monte, I know you never played the Arkham games, but there's a pretty good wrap-up they have for that character where Mr. Freeze is finally kind of able to move on and let go of that, but that is not what General Thaddeus Ross is doing here.
And I thought at first, I thought it was going to be like a Mr. Freeze thing where he was like, oh, there may be, where he was going to be like, oh, there may be a chance to save her or something, but he's like, oh, no, she's dead. Like, she's gone. Like, she's not coming back. I'm just...
Yeah.
And it's like, so what are you doing then, Ross? What's going on here? What's going on in that noggin?
But I think that's the thing. Like, he loves two things. Like, he loves Betty and he loves the military and he loves the power of the military. And Betty can help him continue to expand that other love. Like, she can in service, in her death, she can serve his other love. And I think, you know, much like Mr. Freeze, it probably started out as, I'm going to try to resurrect my wife or try to resurrect my daughter here. But then somewhere along the lines, the pathway that you take and the things that you do just kind of consume you and they become your purpose. Like, the chaos becomes the purpose. You know what I'm saying? So, and I think for him, I know I can't bring Betty back. So the purpose now is for me to control the Hulk and everything associated with this. And I'll use Betty to do it. And I think she becomes his justification for his psychosis when it comes to his, you know, obsession with the Hulk. So it's morbid in a lot of ways, but, you know, it's deep, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm kind of wondering where it's going to go also. Like, where does it go from here? Because they've got Blonsky now.
Mm-hmm.
So what is he...
What is the plan from here?
Yeah, what's your end game, Ron?
What are you thinking in there? What's this 3D chess game that you're playing here?
It's like a scientific experiment where you have a really specific monster creature. What happens if you psychologically torture him for 10 days or something? Maybe that's what the plan is.
Mm-hmm. If we know anything from the Hulk, it seems like he's going to get stronger, break out, and smash everything. But maybe not. Maybe not.
I was going to say, did anybody else dislike Len, his psychiatrist?
I was just about to bring up Len.
Yes.
Because I didn't like Len.
Pray tell.
As, you know, as I sit here sipping on the Leonard, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. The Doc Len Sampson.
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't really pick up much on him, Melissa. What was it that made you not like him?
Just everything he said, I think. I think it was both his, what most he looked like, and everything, what he said. That was what I didn't like.
He does, like, and I was planning to talk about mental health a little bit so we can get into this. Like, we often say when we read a story that, like, everyone in this story should be in therapy. And in this one, we actually have a character who's in therapy. And we get to actually see kind of a session, although it's kind of also a confrontation between the two. So
yeah, he's in therapy. It just happens to be the case that he's in therapy with the therapist who is probably one of the least ethical therapists around. I always like it when Leonard Sampson like makes appearances in comics. He like pops up in a few X-Men stories also, and like in a bunch of stuff. He's like one of the go-to therapists, and he's always doing something that is like a gross violation of ethics.
Yes.
For therapists. He can't follow his oaths.
it's like his oath is do harm. You know, it's like
his oath is
maximize harm.
It's like as much pain as I can cause. Like do harm. Like as much
do most harm.
Do most harm. Like
I don't. But, he like treats his patients like they're experiments, which. Right. You know, he's supposed to be a therapist, not a psychologist. And even if he was a psychologist, like doing actual study on, you know, doing actual experiments and stuff, like.
You need just, like consent.
Yeah, you need consent. You need to follow like the methods.
Nah.
Or the scientific method. And he's just like, well, let's see if I tell this person this, or if I give this person this advice, they might do something. You know, this might make them a little more volatile. They might do something pretty cool. So I'm just going to go ahead and say it.
He's the Hugo Strange of Marvel. You know, ooh. Like his entire, you know, shtick is I'm going to, you know, help you come to grips with all of these things that are swirling on inside of you. But I think in a lot of ways, he's using these therapy sessions with all these characters to really try to understand himself, because like he's, you know, he's kind of a Hulk light. You know what I'm saying? Like he's, you know, he's one of those things that, you know, is on the periphery of the Hulk world. Like, you know, he's not, you know, A-Bomb or any of these other characters or, you know, or the Red Hulk. He's just kind of floating out there.
A-Bomb is a great name.
Yeah. Like he's just kind of floating out there. And so I think there's a little bit of envy. A lot of times with how he sees himself, like kind of juxtaposed versus the Hulk. And so this is his way of exerting some power over these people. So
that makes sense.
Yeah. He's kind of weird in a lot of ways, but you understand it. It's like, I guess maybe I understand it, but yeah, he's the Marvel Hugo Strange.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's one of those characters that's not, he's obviously not a hero, and I wouldn't even say that he's necessarily even in support of a lot of the other characters. But he's not a villain, you know.
Right.
He's definitely not a villain, but he's not good.
He's an entity that's there. Yeah, I think probably like superhero worlds open us up for a lot of like thought experiments about like what if this were possible? Like we've talked about with the X-Men, there's not really a direct corollary for the X-Men and the kind of prejudice they face in the world, but you can apply a lot of things to it. And you have a world with unique people who are superheroes, and you have one person who's like, I'm the therapist for superheroes. You probably have like this veneer of, you know, I'm dealing with extraordinary people. I can use extraordinary methods, but at the same time, that's like a veil for concealing all your own prerogative things that you're doing.
And I would compare him a lot to Emma Frost, actually, who is like one of my favorite characters to ever exist or be written in any kind of story. But Emma Frost has a lot of the same thing where she's like, she's a therapist.
Right. A psychic therapist.
Yeah, a psychic therapist. And she abuses her patients to no end. But at least Emma Frost is upfront and real. And Emma Frost is like, Emma Frost doesn't pretend to be a legitimate therapist or a legitimate psychiatrist the way that Leonard Sampson does. Like, Emma Frost is upfront about the fact that she manipulates people and she likes it. And sometimes she does it to make them better. Sometimes she does it because she wants to. Sometimes she does it for revenge. Like, she's upfront about that. Whereas Leonard Sampson is like, no, I'm really, really trying to help you. Like, I promise I am. And it's like, well, I don't really think you are.
main takeaway for me is that if you have a therapist that isn't helping you, there is no shame in finding a different therapist.
Yes.
Thumbs
just
up.
A reminder. Just yes. a good example. Yes. If you get a Len, someone that's not a Len.
Yes. So do we want to talk about, I'm kind of hesitant to talk about multiple personality disorder or dissociative identity disorder as it is now known, because I'm kind of in a transition of understanding it myself, because it's had a lot of, like, it's this super movieified thing to it doesn't exist, yeah. to it does this type of thing. But I wasn't able to find necessarily that Bruce Banner has a formal diagnosis of dissociative identity disorder or multiple personality disorder, as it may have been called at various times. But that is a condition that has a lot of misrepresentation in the media, along with some other conditions like schizophrenia and borderline personality disorder and bipolar disorder. So do you have any feelings about the way that this character is structured with his various kinds of Hulk personalities, even apart from it being a representation of a real personality disorder?
Yeah, I think the interaction between him and Professor Hulk was kind of telling. He named Professor Hulk as the forgiving side of his personality. Like right. he pointed that out. Like he said, you know, you forgave him, I didn't, because you're the forgiving side of my personality. Like, mm-hmm. so what he said, you know, essentially that was essentially giving each of the iterations of the Hulk, you know, some form of label in his conscience and in his psyche. Like, so, you know, I think there's, you know, you look at some of the different ones, the Savage and, you know, Grey Hulk and ultimately, you know, the Maestro who will emerge later. Like, I think all of these things are just kind of, you know, evolutions of him as a person. Like the more cynical he gets, the more, you know, disillusioned he gets with society, the more, you know, frantic he may get to solve things and achieve things. Like all these things affect the ultimate, development of each Hulk. So it's really, you know, you look at, you know, Bruce Banner is the root of the tree, and each of these things branch off, you know, the base of the tree, and each of these, you know, Hulks kind of branch off from his, you know, fractured, you know, personality and psyche. So,
yeah, I think, in terms of like the way that dissociative identity disorder is portrayed in media, this character, I mean, so there's no actual definition of what dissociative identity disorder is. And there's still quite a few like psychologists who don't think that it's an actual thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or think that it's something that it's a diagnosis that's much better
as part of another diagnosis.
Yeah, it's a disorder that's much better explained and treated with like as another disorder, like as borderline personality or something like that, or schizophrenia or whatever. So I don't think that you can really say what is and isn't an accurate portrayal of dissociative identity disorder, just because there is no actual definition of it, and like its validity as a disorder even is something that's in question.
This was my concern, because I've seen a lot of people coming out on like TikTok and stuff talking about their DID, and I was under the impression,
oh God, Jesus fucking Christ,
I still am very skeptical of that, but the way it was being discussed, because I didn't actually see those things, I saw a discussion of those, and the way it was being discussed there threw me off a little bit, because I was like, just a few years ago I was under the impression from like, you know, pop science articles that this was not its own thing, and now it's being discussed like it is. So
yes.
Before coming into this episode, I was really trying to find like articles about what is the holistic scientific view of this right now, because it seems like it's changing very yeah. fast all the time.
Well, it's still in the DSM, so it's still it is an actual legitimate disorder that some people like would diagnose with.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, though, for bringing up my two least favorite things in the world, TikTok and pop psychology. Yes.
I don't mean so much pop psychology, but like...
No, I mean like internet psychology, yeah. Like Tumblr depression and all that bullshit.
This was like a Psychology Today article about witnessing the trend of people on TikTok and Tumblr posting videos about themselves. Yeah.
No, that doesn't... Pop psychology is not something that I hate. I think that psychology should be something that should be made like digestible and understandable to like the most people possible. But it's just getting on TikTok to make videos about a very severe and life-altering disorder is something that offends me on a personal level. but also, I guess, so what I was going to say is, while there's no actual definition of it, I do think that sometimes portrayals like the one in The Hulk, or, I mean, there's a lot of characters in comic books that have multiple personalities.
Right. Or we just had Split came out a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Glass.
And they, like, they talk to each other, like, the personalities talk to each other, they, like, have all the... Legion is one of my... Mm-hmm. It's one of my favorite TV shows and also one of my favorite characters, but it is a horrible, 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 horrible representation of mental
health.
Four
horribles.
Yes, four horribles. I could have even gone with five, but I thought that might be excessive. It's a pretty terrible representation of what dissociation actually is, and it reinforces a lot of like negative stereotypes and a lot of the, you know, the hype that led to the explosion of multiple personality disorder and dissociative identity disorder actually being diagnosed when it probably shouldn't have been. So it's like, it's one of those things that I have conflicting feelings about, because on the one hand, it's fascinating to watch and it makes for like really great stories like this one and really great characters. Like Legion and Hulk and Typhoid Mary and all of these really cool people.
Crazy Jane.
Yes, Crazy Jane.
Crazy Jane.
We love Crazy Jane.
Yeah. She's so good.
So it's like conflicting feeling, because it's like you would hope that people would see these characters and that would be the jumping off point to be like, well, let me learn more about this and see what it actually is, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, you would hope that that would be the thing that would happen, but it's not going to. And not to, like, blame people or be like, oh, everybody's stupid, that's why they won't. Like, people just don't have time or energy to, you know, you only have so much that you can learn about and do in a day. So, like, if you see these representations that are fantastical and exaggerated and a little bit unrealistic, it can cause you to have ideas about the people who actually struggle with the disorders that are inaccurate. And then the flip side to that is that it can cause someone who is struggling with something like schizophrenia or borderline personality to be like, oh, this is what's happening with me. And it's like, well, it might not. And it might actually make what they're experiencing a lot worse than it needs to be. But they do make such great stories.
Such interesting concepts.
I just want to say that I think that, you know, now I'm, you know, I hate the fact that a pandemic had to cause it, but I think that grief now is getting focus and mental health now is getting focus because there's so much of it being seen today because of the isolation factor of the pandemic. And people have been separated for a year, and human contact, sometimes as problematic as it is still so necessary. And that, you know, now we're actively taking a look at mental health. And I know that, you know, on my podcast, I talk about policy as well. I talk about, you know, healthcare policy and how these things manifest in our society and how relevant they are. And so to see mental health now being elevated to the same level as general healthcare, like, we don't, you know, kind of have a sidebar when we talk about mental health anymore. It's included in the general health conversation. And so, you know, for all the bad things that happen you can always find some type of silver lining in it, is that now we are able to focus on, you know, this thing that has kind of been pushed away because it was uncomfortable for us to talk about.
For sure. I'd love to see the normalization of caring for yourself psychologically. So I provided you guys with some lists of superheroes and their nemeses. And I think there's a little bit of, not disagreement, but various choices for who the Hulk's nemesis might be. But some people consider the Abomination to be his nemesis. So I just wanted to kind of explore, both for the Hulk and for whatever other heroes are your favorites or that come to mind, like, what does it mean to have a nemesis? What is your nemesis usually like, and what does it reflect about you? And especially in this confrontation with your nemesis, where it seems like Banner really got the victory in, at least in this, at least for now in this situation. Like, what do you think about having a nemesis for superheroes?
Well, but did he get the victory? Did he overcome his nemesis, or did he become his nemesis?
That's like 100% a good point, Monte, because what I noticed about a lot of these nemeses is that they're like almost exactly the same person as the hero, just opposite in some small way. I know we talked about how you don't necessarily consider the Joker to be the same or opposite as Batman, but I always see it that way. And then there's a bunch of other heroes who their nemesis is like almost the exact same person, or was created in the same incident, or looks the same, or they used to be best friends, or, you know, goes on and on. Like Magneto and Charles Xavier.
Or Shredder and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yes.
Just kidding.
I always think of Sabretooth and Wolverine.
Yes, very good example.
I always think of them, and like, to them, it's like they're the same person, but they choose. There's just the choice. Like, Wolverine has no qualms about eviscerating people. Like, he doesn't care. Like, he has no whatsoever hesitation. He will hunt you down. He will cut you to ribbons. But, you know, he has a code about it. You know what I'm saying? And Sabretooth will just, you know, randomly on a Tuesday go into a bar and slaughter everyone. Why? Because he just felt like it. They're both killers. They're both, you know, very, you know, animalistic in the way they operate. But it's just the choice that they make in how they manage these urges in their psyche. Like, it's just the choices. One of them will say, I'll use this in order to, you know, accomplish the greater good. And the other one is just like, I'm just going to live. Like, I'm the apex predator. I'm going to go out and I'm going to do what apex predators do. And it's just the choice. It could easily be that Sabretooth is, you know, with the X-Men, and Wolverine is the guy out, you know, on the street hunting and killing people. It could very easily be that, but it's just the way that, you know, the characters make the choice on how to deal with their savagery.
And this, I think, is what we discussed when we were discussing the Killing Joke and trying to pick apart the theme, which was kind of hidden, which was that the Joker thinks that Batman and he could be the same and could be friends. And Batman knows that as well, and knows that it's only his, you know, strict rules about not killing and his strict rules about not going over that one last line that keeps them from being the same person. Just a very violent, psychotic person who thinks that they get to impose their will on other people.
Yes.
And yeah, looking at this list,
which,
like,
is what Batman is.
It is what he is. That's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. They're the same.
Which one are we talking about?
Both.
Which one are we talking about?
Yeah. But even like looking at this list, like for Green Lantern, it's Sinestro, who seems like he has the exact same powers pretty much, but is the yellow version. And there's all kinds of ones like that. Not everyone. Some people I can't really pick out how they're opposite, or how they're the same but opposite, like Daredevil and Kingpin.
I think Daredevil and Kingpin is interesting because they both see themselves as saviors of Hell's Kitchen. You know what I'm saying? Like, they, you know, it's very similar to the Superman Lex, you know, kind of split.
That was the other one I was going to bring up.
Like, Lex Luthor is, he is so desperate to be superhuman, even though he is in a way, if you look at his intellect, like he's superhumanly intelligent. But it's the thing you don't have that is the always the thing that you want. And he sees Superman as this god, but he sees himself as a god in a way too, but just a lesser god than the guy who flies around and can shoot laser beams out of his eyes and move a mountain. And so the love that people have for Superman, he believes he should have it because ultimately he thinks when it comes down to it that he'll be the one that saves the world. And so he sees himself as you know, as a savior of the world. It's just that this other guy is in the way from people realizing that it's him. And I think Daredevil and Kingpin, you know, kind of that run that same along that same pathway, but you know, to kind of a more planetary scale, you know.
Yes, I guess they don't have to be the same from our point of view, so long as one of them sees the other one as like them, but something they want to achieve, comparable to the point where they're like, if I just had that one last thing, I could be that person.
I think it's also like with Daredevil, Kingpin, and Lex Luthor, Superman, and then also like Red Skull and Captain America. I think it's really interesting, like the way that both of them are kind of like the ideals of the American dream versus this corruption of the American dream. And especially with Superman and Lex Luthor, like you've got Superman on the one hand, who's like Kansas born, like he's an undocumented immigrant from Kansas who was raised on apple pie and like fully embraces the American dream, versus Lex Luthor, who's like this corporatist kind of, you know, evil mega billionaire megalomaniac. And his plots often are about like how money can just, how money is in itself a superpower, like being rich is a superpower basically. In our capitalist system, and the way that you can really manipulate the system that Superman like idealizes so much, just if you have enough money to do it. And kind of the same with Kingpin and Daredevil, whereas like Daredevil's the lawyer who's like fighting for the little person and protecting like their piece of the pie, whereas Kingpin is like, no, the way that you get power is by having money. Like, the way that you get power and the way that you can protect the people that you want to protect, because Kingpin has, like, I can't remember his wife's name, but he has people that he cares very deeply about, and he protects, like, very, very, like, rabidly, but it's just the way that he goes about doing it is a way that's not moral or good or in line with what we would hope the American dream to be, right, or the American ideals to be. I also think like Magneto and Professor Xavier are like, I love X-Men obviously, so I think X-Men characters are the best characters. But I do think that Professor X and Magneto are like one of the best examples of arch nemesis that you'll find, just because both of them are so ruthless and they're so single-minded. And like we read in Magneto, Not a Hero, where Magneto was just like, look, you guys don't understand. I don't care about any of you. Like, all I care about is my goals and the way that I'm going to achieve them. And I think Professor Xavier wouldn't say that, but that is how he feels. Like, right. That is his character. He wouldn't say it, but it is the truth.
Because he doesn't necessarily have the X-Men to help people. Like, that is what they do. But his underlying, like, plan is to essentially, like, PR for mutants, right? Like, he has this squad that protect humans to show that mutants aren't evil and to elevate their position in the world. Not necessarily just to protect non-mutants.
And so I think that both of them are, they're just characters that are so very similar, but it's very easy to lose sight of the ways that they're similar, and it's very easy to think of them as opposites, but they're like, they're definitely not. And I think you can see the difference in their methods. Like, Magneto has had a very traumatic life, whereas Professor Xavier has had a very charmed life. And so maybe the reason that Magneto is a little more rough around the edges is because, you know, he was literally created in the Holocaust. Like, the Holocaust created Magneto, and country clubs created Professor Xavier. So, like, yeah, Magneto's a little bit, his methods are a little bit rough. He's a little bit genocide-y. But can you blame him?
Right.
Well, I mean, we should.
Yeah, you can. You can blame him.
You know, which is ironic, considering, you know, he was born in a genocide, you know? Right. You know, so, but I agree, and I'm finally glad to see someone else or some other people who have come to the realization that Charles Xavier is not this squeaky clean, you know, Martin Luther King type, you know, character, you know, who is all about, you know, integration and kumbaya moments. Like,
he's got his own goals.
He's a ruthless guy. Like, he's, you know, he's not above, you know, doing some of the things that he knows that normal humans would be afraid of doing if they found out that he did. Like, he's not above doing those things. And so I think, you know, that's a, you know, really good point to be aware of, is that sometimes, you know, your goals overcome your ideals. They overcome the morals. And so the means, some, you know, they will look at it and say the means will justify the end. And that may be the difference point between you being a hero and you being a villain. Like, Batman will say, life would be so much easier if I offed the Joker, you know?
But he said that many times.
Right, right. At this point, if I find out how easy it would be to kill him, who's to say that it wouldn't be easy for me to off Killer Croc or somebody else?
Right. And it's more about his own Maginot line, his own point where his psyche is going to move, more than it's about the results of his actions on other people.
And I think it's also a realization that he knows that he is just that one slip up away from being the Joker. Like, he knows that. Like, that's one of, like, sometimes I criticize Batman for not being self-aware, but I think in this aspect is he's extremely self-aware of where he is. And like, if you look at, you know, the Dark Knights, you know, the metal series, you look at all the different Batman that arose, you look at all the different, you know, the Batman that arose from this, like, these are all instances of him, like, giving in or not having those morals instilled or nothing, or not having an Alfred or whatever it may be. And you see what he becomes in multiple different versions and universes. So he's very aware. And I think that's the difference between him and a lot of heroes and villains in a lot of ways, is that they have that one speck of awareness that says, I'm, you know, one murder away from being, my villain.
Yes. I was just, we read an X Factor arc a few episodes ago, this season, actually. And I've been continuing reading it. And there's a small arc later in that volume where Multiple Man, Madrox, what's his face? He gets, like, desynced from his reality and is bouncing around to different ones. And you see different versions of, like, there's a version where Captain America is evil and is, like, just killing everybody, called, like, Deathlok, I think. I don't know if that's a character in its own series elsewhere, if that just exists in this arc. But, like, yeah, you can see how various heroes, Iron Man is present. I think you go to a world where Doctor Strange was, and you see how they would be different if their circumstances were different, and how they're like, I love the phrase two sides of the same coin. I think it gets at a really interesting literary concept with a very good visual. But yeah, just the way that if things were just switched a little bit, you would be a very different person, and maybe the opposite person and your own nemesis.
Well, isn't that Two-Face's philosophy?
Yes.
Plus coin, plus you live long enough to see yourself become the villain. Kind of deal.
Yes.
But going back to, bringing it back to Hulk and Abomination, I don't know that much about Abomination. Like, literally all I really know about him is the stuff that was in this comic. But he seems like a really good foil to the Hulk, just because they were created out of the same sort of circumstances similarly. But I think that it's interesting that he can't shift back, like he can't shift back into being a normal person. And it's a lot more, like a lot of times the Hulk is portrayed as being like Bruce Banner stuck inside the Hulk. But with Blonsky, you see what the actual result of that would be, because like Blonsky's intellect and his psyche are like completely intact. They're just trapped in this body that's incredibly powerful, but also prevents him from ever living a normal life, which would be very difficult. And it's interesting to think, like, what would Bruce Banner be like if that were the case for him? And there are characters like that. Like, there's Maestro, who is very similar to this portrayal of Blonsky, at least, where he's this, like, ruthless kind of monster.
I don't know if this is a real thing in the comics, but I remember in the masterpiece that was the Fantastic Four movie that had Chris Evans as the Human Torch. But in that movie, the Things, that's what he's called, right? The Thing?
Mm-hmm.
The Thing's thing, whole arc was about, you know, moving past the fact that he's outwardly a monster now and like reclaiming his humanity and his relationships with people. And yeah, there's lots of characters who are like, I mean, being mutated and transformed is a very recurring trope and motif in superhero comics.
Beast.
Yes. So, yeah. And when I was giving my synopsis of the Hulk's background and whatnot, we know that the Hulk was separated from the woman he loved for a long time because he didn't think that he could go back to her until he thought that he was free of his, like, his curse, as it were. So they really have a lot in common, and it's just the way who you consider to be the hero based on what actions they decide to take. All right, so to wrap up with my last question of every episode of this season, what does it mean for the Hulk to be green?
Sad.
Yes.
Final answer.
I think you're right, honestly. With the dissociative identity, like, each identity means different emotions and different motivations. So, yeah, I think so. Not rage like you would think. Sad.
No. Sad.
Well, anger is a secondary emotion, as we know.
Isn't rage just sadness?
Yeah. There's this awful movie my sister likes called Gretchen. Don't watch it. It will it'll ruin your day. But her therapist in that tells her that anger is a secondary emotion, which means it's born of other emotions. Mm. It's a reaction to, you know, sadness or whatever you feel. So, yeah, I would agree. Rage is the next step on from whatever emotion is overwhelming you. In this case, sadness.
Yeah.
Valid. Okay.
And sadness turns to rage very quick. He's not green with envy about anything except... No. Maybe he's green with envy for Blonsky because Blonsky's love interest is alive.
Is alive. And
unobtainable, but alive.
I mean, she might take him back. He could try.
How unobtainable is something that you haven't even tried to obtain? Right.
I mean, the Thing found love, you know.
Exactly.
The Thing eventually found love. I mean, so he had someone that, except, I mean, she was blind, but, you know. He found love. I mean, he found, you know, she eventually, you know, but so he, I think Blonsky's is self, and he's kind of, you know, self-imposed this prison on himself. Like,
yeah,
he doesn't know how his wife would react to hearing his voice and having her say, you know, oh my God, Emil, you're alive. He, you know, the prison that he's trapped in at the end, you know, of hearing her say, I love you always, no matter what, he's afraid to challenge that. Like, he doesn't, like, he, like, it's torturing him, but it's the only thing that's keeping him going, you know?
Right. It's based on fear.
That. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's simply because he's, like, a giant, like, monster now. And not because she has moved on, she's gotten married, she has kids. Like, we're not even talking about, like, she's in a different stage of her life. Like, the only time we see her, she's like at the gym. I mean, so anything could be happening. So at this point, every obstacle in his way is just self-made and self, he's convinced himself that there's no point in trying, but I'm still gonna kind of like harass her a little bit.
He's still obsessed with, it's not like he's decided, I'm too afraid to see what happens, so I'm going to move on. He's still obsessed, but he's not able to move past that moment where he's like, I'm afraid of what she would say, so I'll just assume the worst, because to actually ask would be to have hope. And I can't allow myself hope, because I'm afraid. So for, would you say that the abomination is green? He looked green sometimes and yellow sometimes.
Yeah, I think he was green.
Yeah, so for him being green is fear.
Yes.
So, after this rousing and fascinating discussion, what are you guys' general impressions on the way out?
I will leave my comment, like this comic, short and sweet. That's it. It was short and sweet.
A comment about your comment. Excellent.
Yeah, I really liked it. I enjoyed it. Good discussion, good story.
For sure.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is a really good story. Touches a lot of things.
Yep. I really enjoyed our conversation and all the points that you guys brought out. So, really recommended as an onboarding point for the Hulk as well to all our listeners. All right. So, that brings us to our favorite panels. And as the one who chose this comic, I will be going first. My favorite panel, really it's the whole page, but I'll narrow it down, is in issue 25, pretty close to the beginning. I think it even, like, leads on from the cover splash page, where it's, like, Bruce Banner is, I think he's, like, in the, what is it called in Get Out? The
Sunken Place?
The Sunken Place, where he's, like, inside his psyche, and he's, like, lying on the ground being, like, rained on and buried in water, and just, like, going through all these, like, reasoning with himself, talking about how... He's talking to Betty, essentially saying, I already got through this. How could you have done this to me, brought me back to this place? And I just really like the progression of this page where it's like slowly zooming in on him. He's in his like toe up Hulk pants, just like glaring straight into the camera with his like eyes all blacked out. And I guess my favorite panel of all of them is at the bottom where you're like the closest to him. And he just looks so despondent. Like, he's kind of giving up, and I think it's a pretty good illustration of how he's feeling at that moment.
There was a lot of water imagery in this comic.
There was. At one point, I think Monte said that he didn't think the characters were wallowing, and it made me think of how the Abomination is literally wallowing at the bottom of a lake.
Yes. Like, he said the Hulk wasn't wallowing. Everyone else was.
But here's a moment where he's beginning to wallow. He's raining water down on himself in his psyche. To wallow in his sadness. And I thought it was a very well composed page, an interesting example of the art, which the art is excellent.
Yeah.
We never mentioned that, I don't think.
My favorite panel is also in issue 25, and it's about midway through, about a third of the way through, right before Hulk and Abomination start fighting. It's when Abomination is like slowly rising out of the water, and then you see the Hulk in the background, like up against the moon, and Abomination just turns around, and the look on his face, I think, is just what really makes me like it. It's like he's not really upset. He's just like, oh, okay. Like,
here it, you know, comes.
Yeah, like, okay, so now got it.
Cool. It's now the Hulk. We fight.
Falling from the sky.
Hulk is so... The speed with which Hulk can traverse the Earth is so terrifying. I really like how MCU portrays it. He just, like, jumps out of the sky a lot. It just happens.
Yeah.
Terrifying.
It is. And he lands directly on Abomination. Like, he lands directly on top of him. So, you know, He can aim his multi-mile-long leaps very well.
Yes.
He's got good depth perception.
Yeah. It's almost like a supernatural sense.
Calculating vector and trajectory, like, on the go, like, in the middle of the jump.
Banner is a theoretical physicist, so I
That's
hope
true.
He would
That's
be able
true.
To calculate
That's true.
But yeah, I really enjoy his look of resigned, not fear, not excitement, just kind
resignation.
Of a blank, yeah.
Kind of like mild curiosity.
Like, oh.
Yeah.
Hmm? I think is what he says.
Yeah, he's like,
All right. How about you, Michael?
Well, we've kind of talked about my favorite panel or page. We've talked about the torture scene. I don't know. I don't know what that says about me that that's my favorite one. but it's really the last. It's really the last panel. Like, as he's walking away. he's choosing to transform into the Hulk.
Yes.
Like, he's not angry. He's not out of control. He's not aggrieved. He's choosing to transform into the Hulk as he walks away. And so I think this was the realization that maybe, just maybe, he's been the monster the whole time. Like, he sees himself as much of a monster as any of the Hulks or the Abomination, because, you know, he had a chance to keep the forgiveness that Professor Hulk had, but he chose to throw it away and seek vengeance. And then he chose to go in and torture Blonsky. Like, you deserve this. Like, you you have to have it. And it was so not hero-esque. It was not, you want to cheer for Bruce, but you look at that and like, that's not a hero right at that moment. And I think that's when he walks away and he's like, you know what? I just did something monstrous. I'm going to be a monster. And I think that was his choice to transform for the first time. And it's like, yeah, that said so much about this, about these two issues. I think it summed it up.
Yeah, I think that's a really, there's various like meanings to pick out of it, but I feel like it's a very poignant ending. Like, it, you feel something when that happens, even if you can't quite put your finger on it. Awesome.
My favorite panel is the only one from issue 24. So, and I've already mentioned it. It's one where Abomination is giving his class at the library on creative writing. And he just, honestly, he didn't seem like a great teacher because he kind of just is really rude to his students and is really, you know, kind of just tears them down a little bit, which I don't think is the point of creative writing.
No.
A free class at the library, but whatever. And he decides to be like, you got to pull from experience, and then just kind of jumps into his like whole life story, and everyone's like crying at the end, and someone says, oh, what happened to Emil? Did he get back together with his wife? And he goes, no, happy endings are for lazy writers. And that one was just my favorite because he's in a giant cloak, his face is in shadow, and he's just this hulking giant cloaked man in a library yelling at people who want to learn how to write better. And it was delightful.
Your stories are terrible. Listen to this one. It's much better.
He's so critical, but also so supportive. It's bizarre.
Right.
He's like, I love, you're all my precious, precious students, and you're so good. Your writing is trash. It should be like-
But you're so good.
Right.
Yeah.
What? So, I think that's gaslighting. I think.
No. I think he just wanted an excuse to tell his story and found out a good like way to get in there.
You all suck. Listen to my
Let me tell you a good story.
Sir, this is a Wendy's, please.
Exactly. All right. Well, I'm going to take all of these favorite panels. I'm going to post them to our Instagram. So check us out. Let us know what your favorite panels were. Our Instagram handle is SJW Comics Cast. And with that, I will take us into our self-care corner where we promote self-care, emotional, physical, mental, the other one.
Spiritual.
And we encourage our listeners to practice self-care. So what is something that you guys did last week that promoted your self-care?
I'll go first because mine is probably going to be the shortest. It's what I already said, which was watching all of the Godzilla and King Kong movies.
Doing the things you want to do.
Yes.
Mine is probably physical. I had a flare-up of my usual back pain, and I just really tried to do the things that are good for it, even if I didn't want to, because generally it's getting up and pushing through it that makes it better for me. So instead of lazing around coddling myself, which isn't always the answer, a lot of the time you have to give yourself space and not be hard on yourself. But I knew that I would be better if I worked hard at it in this situation. And I did. And I am out of my flare up now.
That's good.
I took a day off.
Ooh.
I know that doesn't sound like self-care, but, you know, between my day job, busy executive in my other job, busy public servant, I don't get much time off. So I took a day off and I turned off my phone. I turned off my work phone and I did nothing.
Very nice.
And struggled with it for a little bit, and then I got into my groove, and doing nothing is awesome. So yeah, that was it. And so I just watched all the things that I said that, you know, I told you guys in the beginning, and I did all that on my day off.
That's very awesome. Nice.
We are all millennials with over-demanding office jobs, so we definitely would all agree that taking a day off is self-care, and yes, that doing nothing is the best thing to do.
So much PTO in America goes unused, and a lot of it is not cashed out also, so I would definitely encourage everyone to make use of your PTO.
For sure. I don't have any PTO at the moment, but I will in a couple of months, guys.
Nice. Mm.
So, fingers crossed. My self-care for last week was getting my first shot of the COVID-19 vaccine. And it wasn't horrible, but it also, you know, a little sore the next day. So, but it was more of a mental self-care. So, maybe if physically I'm like, meh, and it's like long-term physical self-care, but I am so ready. I'm so ready for this all to be over.
Yes. If everyone could get to that place where they're like, I am taken care of for X amount of time after being worried for more than a year. All right. So, yes, everyone else, also please take care of yourselves. It's very important in these trying times. Next week, Monte, what will we be reading?
Next week, we are going to read Harley Quinn and Poison Ivy. Numbers 1-6, it's the full story arc, the full volume, it's just a limited series. So we are going to be looking at the relationship between Poison Ivy and Harley Quinn.
Yes.
Which should be pretty interesting. It'll be the second Poison Ivy story that we read this season.
Yes. And we had a tiny sample of relations between Harley Quinn and Poison Ivy in that one.
Yeah, so we'll get to explore that more fully.
Excellent. And as always, we will be linking to that comic on Comixology in the episode description of this episode. You can also probably find it on Amazon and possibly in your local public library or bookstore. But that is it for this week. If you enjoyed our show, please like and subscribe. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, please leave a 5-star rating. We would appreciate it very much. If you want to keep up with us on social media, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at SJWComicsCast or email us directly at SJWComicsPodcast@gmail.com. Michael, where can they find you?
I can be found on Apple Podcasts, on Pandora, under Superhero Politics. I can be found on Instagram, Twitter, Superhero Politics, Facebook, Superhero Politics. So I'm, you know, just search for Superhero Politics and you will find me. So like, subscribe, share. And I really appreciate you guys having me on.
Yes. Thank you very much for coming. And we recommend everyone take a look at Michael's podcast.
Yes.
We had an awesome conversation.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. So this was our podcast. We will see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.